minor and thought her new teacher would be impressed. She listened and then said, "Now, darling, I will teach you how to play the piano." She took all my books off the piano, threw them on the floor, and said, "Play a scale." So I played a C major scale. Then she started saying, "Play G minor. Play B flat major. Play in counter motion. Play four octaves." She was asking me to do things I'd never heard of before. My whole life caved in and crashed down. Candy's mother had been somewhat intimidated by Langford, but she was in awe of Lily Krause. She took home the teacher's dresses to mend. Candy displaced a lot of feeling onto her new teacher. If you have the strong personality of a world-famous concert artist in your life at the age of 11, how can that not overshadow your mother? She said. I wanted to emulate Krause in every way. Candy developed a rapport with Krause beyond her mother's reach, but her mother became her drill sergeant, keeping her at the piano for hours every day. Nothing came before that, Candy said. Ever. For a year and a half, Candy played nothing but exercises, arpeggios, trills, scales, cherney, scales in thirds, scales in octaves. I thought I was going to go insane. What happened to the concertos? Finally, Krause decided Candy was ready for a Mozart sonata. They established a routine. Krause would tour in Europe all summer, during which time Candy would have music to learn by heart. When Madame returned in September, Candy would relearn those same pieces the right way. Candy's father was offered promotions, but they involved moving, which was unthinkable as long as Candy was studying with Krause. It became a running joke to introduce Candy as Lily Krause's student, who is the next winner of the Cliburn competition, which for Candy would ratchet that bolt and screw tighter and tighter. She wanted to go to Juilliard, but couldn't bear to leave Krause. "I'm the only student who learned the real technique that Krause had," she said. "I spent 14 years with her to earn it." But Candy decided that she wanted to make her mark playing the concerto version of Schubert's Wanderer Fantasy, and Krause said, "I'm the only pianist who plays that piece." It was the beginning of trouble. Madame Krause was fighting to continue her career as long as possible, Candy said. She wanted my youth, and she couldn't have it. Candy felt pressured by her mother's focus and her father's missed career opportunities. She felt pushed by Krause to triumph in a way that would elevate but not overshadow Krause's own reputation. She felt the lingering burdens of Langford's hopes and of being an adopted child who needed to prove herself worthy enough not to be abandoned. She felt the terrible anxiety that had begun with her sideshow act around Texas. She enrolled at TCU, where she began to struggle more and more with her work and physical health. She was, at last, preparing to enter the Cliburn competition, playing the Prokofiev Piano Concerto No. 2. Shortly before the competition, she became terribly ill and lost 30 pounds in a month. Doctors diagnosed her with anorexia, and for the next 5 years she became weaker and weaker. Eventually she was down to 85 pounds, though she is 5'10". Her kidneys were giving out, and she was put on life support. Krause wrote in her diary that she was saying goodbye to Candy before she died. In the hospital, Candy pondered her despair. "I accused my mother many times, 'You don't love me because I didn't win the Cliburn competition.' I thought she'd seen me only as the piano prodigy. Madame Krause loved me, I was her baby, and she called me Candy Bandy. But it was always Candy Bauckham, pianist. Why can't it just be Candy Bauckham, person?" She finally learned that she had Crohn's disease. It took her a year to walk again. When she was nearly 30, she wrote to Lily Krause, "I have to leave you, Madam Krause. I have to leave Fort Worth, and my parents, and my world as I know it, and jump into New York City." Candy sold everything she had to pay for Juilliard. "My parents were in tears," she recalled. "They knew I needed to do something, but they really didn't know what was ahead." What she discovered at Juilliard was people. "I was so tired of being alone, on the road, in my career, in my life, in every way, all the time," she recalled. Candy became romantically involved with a violinist at Juilliard, Andrew Shast. Andy was offered a job with the Dallas Symphony, and Candy married him and returned to Texas. Not long afterward, the marriage started to fall apart. "He was the esteemed conductor, and I had nothing to do," Candy recalled. Her relationship to Krause had been poisoned by Krause's one-upmanship. Now she found it difficult not to compete with her husband. "I was ready to leave him," she said. Then she discovered she was pregnant. Motherhood unexpectedly united them. It focused Candy's energies on someone other than herself. "As a prodigy, you're always the most important person in the room," she said. "Miss Perfect, that's who I'd always been, and now it wasn't about me. As it turns out, that's what I really wanted all along." Candy eventually became the organist and musical director at the local Episcopal church. "When I attended services there, I asked some of the congregants what they made of the music. Everyone knew she was a fine musician, but many of them didn't listen to classical music outside church, and some had never liked it before joining St. Andrew's. Listening to Candy play there felt a little like Babette's Feast. As the congregation stood up and sat down and fumbled with their hymnals, while perfectly sublime harmonies cascaded all around them. The parents of a prodigy cannot know whether that child will have sufficient skill for a career in music, and equally cannot know whether that child will want such a life. The pressure can be overwhelming, and even those who like performing may not want to live with constant travel that makes sustained relationships nearly impossible. Are parents preparing their child for a life that he or she will actually enjoy in adulthood? Many such parents have a single-minded focus on a solo career and don't deign to explore other ways to have a life in music, such as orchestral and chamber performance. David Waterman's Aunt Fanny, who has been called Britain's best-known piano teacher, founded the Leeds Piano Competition, and both his elder sisters were prodigies. His parents were too worn out to push their third child toward music, too. Instead, he was pressured to become an all-around excellent student, and he decided very definitely against being a prodigy, learning the cello at a recreational pace. As a teenager, he fell in love with chamber music and the sociability it entailed. He joined an amateur quartet while he was an undergraduate studying philosophy at Cambridge, and undertook a PhD there so he could keep his campus housing while he decided whether to become a professional cellist. In 1979, David founded the Endelian String Quartet with three other musicians who had all been prodigies. 30-some years later, the group has had to replace only one member, and is going strong. David described how liberating it was for him to have a broad education and know that he could function in many other areas. That is not to say that his late start did not come at a cost. "If the quartet doesn't play for a week, the level to which I sink in that time is alarming. That doesn't happen to them. I'm sure that's to do with how deeply ingrained their movements are." He acknowledged, however, that a broader education has helped his human relations. "Knowing how to articulate has been very valuable for the quartet," he said. I wondered whether David regretted those lost years of early practice. I'd most likely be a failed soloist instead of a successful chamber musician, he said. I might be a better cellist now if I had made that decision in my teens, but I think I'd be a much less happy person, and that would actually make me a lesser cellist. Musicians such as Ken Noda, Candy Baucom, and David Waterman retain a quieter life in music than their parents fantasized for them. Others decide to keep playing but give up the notion of being heard. I knew someone in college, Louise McCarran, who showed brilliant talent as a pianist. In her early 20s, she was to make her Kennedy Center debut. Her parents hired a bus to take friends and relatives to the performance. 2 days before the concert, everyone received notice that Louise had had an injury and would be unable to play. I thought it might be repetitive stress from all the practicing, but it was simply that her pinky hurt. In the 25 years since, Louise has never scheduled or made a public performance. She lives alone in an apartment with two pianos and practices 8 hours a day. Dating and marrying are impossible because she must give everything to her art. When she occasionally comes to a party, she introduces herself as a concert pianist, even though she has never given a concert. While a taste for wealth and fame can propel parents of prodigies into exploitation, most are not venal. They are unself-aware and powerless to separate their wishes from their children's. Young children mirror back their parents' ambitions. If you dream of having a genius for a child, you will spot brilliance in your child. And if you believe that fame would have salved all your own unhappiness, you will see a longing for prominence in your son's or daughter's face. While many performers are self-involved, it is often the parents of prodigies who are most obviously narcissistic. They may invest their own hopes, ambitions, and identities in what their children do rather than who their children are. Instead of cultivating curiosity, they may sprint for fame. Though they sometimes seemed pitiless to me, they were seldom vindictive. The abuse they perpetrated reflected a tragic misunderstanding of where one human being ends and another begins. Absolute power corrupts absolutely, and no power is more absolute than parenthood. The children of these parents, despite being the subjects of obsessive attention, suffer from not being seen. Their sorrow is organized not so much around the rigor of practicing as around invisibility. Accomplishment entails giving up the pleasures of the present moment in favor of anticipated triumphs, and that is an impulse that must be learned. Left to their own devices, children do not become world-class instrumentalists before they turn 10. When I spoke to Marion Price on the telephone to set up our interview, I invited her to bring her violinist daughter, Solanda, for dinner. But she said, "We have a family of fussy eaters, so we'll eat before we come." The Prices arrived wearing coats, and I offered to hang them up. Marion, speaking for her husband and daughter as well, said, "That won't be necessary," and they sat through the interview holding their outerwear. I offered them something to drink, but Marion said, "We are so used to our schedule, and it's not time for a drink right now." In 3 hours, none of them had had a sip of water. I had put out homemade cookies, and Solanda kept glancing at them. Every time she did, Marion shot her a look. When I asked Solanda a question, her mother constantly jumped in to answer on her behalf. When Solanda did reply, she did so with an anxious glance at her mother, as though worried whether she'd delivered the right response. The Prices live around their musical talent. Sandra, 10 years older than Salonda, is a pianist. Vikram, 4 years older than Salonda, is a cellist. When Salonda was 5, her parents had all 3 children in a children's orchestra. They now perform as a trio. Marion is African-American. Salonda's father, Ravi, is Indian, and he writes and plays smooth jazz. We're hearing the word gifted. We're hearing the word musical, Marion said. We see 3 children who, when they practice together, it seems like one person. It's an oddity of English that the word play refers both to what children do for fun and what musicians do for a living. And it is misguided to infer from these homonyms that performance and practice are recreational activities. We had music going from the time Salonda was conceived, Marion said. Salonda started piano lessons at 4. But she fell in love with Itzhak Perlman and the violin. Salonda got that violin when she was almost 5. The nurture has always been there, but when you have a child who within a moment of having received that violin, they are making music, there's something innate there as well. Salonda explained, I chose the violin because I thought it sounded like my voice. She began studying at Juilliard just shy of 6, but her instructor was kind of scrambling to keep up with what Salonda really needed, Marion said. Salonda was digesting everything on the spot. She wanted to play the Beethoven D major concerto, the Brahms D major, the Mendelssohn E minor, and music theory is just the air she breathes. All 3 Price children have been homeschooled. Marion develops the curriculum, and Ravi does the actual teaching. I asked Salonda about having friends, and Marion said that Salonda's siblings were her best friends. I asked Salonda what she did for fun. Basically, Juilliard, Salonda said. Salonda had been asked to perform at an important ceremony in the nation's capital. I was nervous, Salonda said. It was very, very shocking to be there, but I played my best, and I didn't mess up. Marion said that both Salonda and the trio had been invited to play all around the country. She played in the Midori and Friends series, and Midori was there. We have the photos to prove it. We're looking for more opportunities. In a rare interpolation, Ravi said, we need to take it up to the next level, where it would be, as necessary, profitable. Marion was clearly embarrassed by the mention of money. There had been a few paid performances, she said, but her children mostly played for joy. And it just so happens that their joy is something that brings joy for others, she explained. I don't consider us to be pushy parents. Involved parents, supportive parents. But I don't think we're pushy. I know what that looks like. I think we're just able to respond to what our children are asking for. In general, I don't ask musicians to perform when I interview them. Marion was holding a violin case in her lap, however, so I asked Salonda if she wanted to play. Marion said, what do you think you'll play, Salonda? Salonda said, I think I'll just play the Bach Chaconne. Marion said, how about the Rimsky-Korsakov? Salonda said, no, the Chaconne is better. I was struck that Salonda had chosen the instrument for its resemblance to her voice. Now it provided her only chance to be heard over her mother. Salonda played the Chaconne. When she finished, Marion said, now you can play the Rimsky-Korsakov. Salonda launched into Flight of the Bumblebee, the proof of every virtuoso. Marion said, Vivaldi? And Salonda played Summer from the 4 Seasons. She played with a clear, bright tone, although not with such brilliance as to resolve the question of why a childhood had been sacrificed for this art. I had hoped Solanda would light up at her instrument, but instead she brought out the violin's searing melancholy. While the behavior of parents can be damaging, those parents can be victimized along with their children by the classical music industry. Many managers seem to believe that the only way to keep a paying audience is to ensure a constant flow of young musicians. There has always been a market for prodigies, but in the past 30 years, the tendency has been to find a new one every week. A machinery has been established by people with short-term interests in the people they are using, for whom even the child's mental health is only a mercenary concern. It's like burning fossil fuels, Justin Davidson said. Constantly replenishing the prodigy supply, you flood the market. These managers are creating an oversupply of people who can do a narrow range of things, many of which are no longer of great interest. They're preparing them for a future that's in the past. It's a bewildering preoccupation, the pianist Mitsuko Uchida said to me. Ask those audiences how they'd like to be represented in court by a 7-year-old. Let them try surgery with a very gifted 8-year-old. The critic Janice Nimura said, "The child prodigy is the polite version of the carny freak. Gawking at the dog-faced boy in the sideshow is exploitative, but gawking at the 6-year-old concert pianist on the Today Show is somehow okay, even inspiring, demonstrating just how high human potential can soar." While etiquette demands that we not stare at dwarfs, it makes no such claim for the privacy of the prodigy. Pushing talented children can backfire. Not pushing them can backfire too. Leonard Bernstein's father, when asked why he opposed his son's career, replied, "How did I know he was going to be Leonard Bernstein?" Doing the interviews for this chapter, I began to feel that half the parents of these children had coerced them into an uncongenial musical life, while the other half had unreasonably held their children back. Jonathan Fleuriel has the dubious distinction of having lived both clichés. As a child in Ecuador in the early 1990s, Jonathan yearned for music lessons. But his mother, Elizabeth, didn't think music important, while his father, Jaime Ivan Fleuriel, who had left the marriage before Jonathan was born, ran a music academy and didn't think his son warranted the training. Jaime finally relented and allowed Jonathan to take piano at 11. Within 3 months, the piano teacher told Jaime that Jonathan had a talent too significant for Ecuador and needed to train in Europe. Jonathan's mother was enraged at the thought of his going abroad and tried to hold on to him through a legal battle for custody. "She was killing me," Jonathan remembered, "because my passion for music was everything." 2 months later, Jaime closed his academy to take his son to Europe. Elizabeth had notified the police that her husband was trying to kidnap Jonathan, so they drove by night across an unmanned border in the Andes to Colombia to board a plane to Madrid. Jonathan, who had studied piano for less than 6 months, was accepted into the 5th year at the Rodolfo Halfter Conservatory. His mother persisted in trying to get him back, and Jonathan had to assert over and over to the Spanish police that he wanted to stay there. "With all the weight that I had from my mother, I didn't know whether what I had done was right or wrong, and my father couldn't tell me," Jonathan said. He started reading for moral guidance, Aristotle's Ethics and Plato's Republic, St. Thomas, José Ortega y Gasset. When he was 20, I asked him what he now thought about his departure to Spain. "My mother said that music would prevent me from living my childhood," he replied. "But I didn't want to live my childhood anymore." Between 11 and 16, Jonathan won more than 20 competitions. His father, who could not find work as a music teacher, took a clerical job instead. "My prodigy time was very, very stressful," Jonathan said. He returned to Ecuador for the first time when he was 15, 4 years after his departure, to play a major concert. Though his mother greeted him there joyously, an unbridgeable gap had opened. The next year, he earned a full scholarship to the Manhattan School of Music. He soon made his debut in Valencia and was reviewed as more than a prodigy because of not only what he performs, but also how he performs. His studies were changing him. "I started to grow into different criteria of musicianship," he said. "My father was asking me to work on repertoire that I thought was senseless. He set himself against me, and I hated him for that. I needed to do something besides win another prize." Having fled his mother in Ecuador, he now left his father. "He wanted me to learn popular selections and make a CD. I thought I was going to get lost in that superficial way of doing music. So he kicked me out of my home in Madrid. I had to pack in 2 hours. It was that drastic." I asked what effect that second exile had had on him, and he said, "It seems to me almost a pilgrimage, the way that I walk as a musician through life. Sometimes I feel that my fingers moving on the keys, it's like how a blind person reads in Braille. There is so much meaning that you find only when you are touching the instrument. I search to bring something noble to the world, something as noble as the passion of Jesus Christ. I'm not actually a religious person, but I believe there's something higher than us that makes music what it is. I can serve that thing, even if I cannot see or know it." At 20, Jonathan will not play a Chopin mazurka without knowing the folk mazurkas that inspired it, and he won't play a nocturne without studying the time of bel canto. "Recently, I have gone back to recordings from the 1930s of Ecuadorian music," he told me. "The way I think and am is still rooted in my country, so I need to keep this part of myself alive." I wondered how the traumas of leaving his mother, then his country, and then his father still echoed. "I do not think there was another way," he said. "I understand why my parents turned against me. We all hate what we don't understand." Gore Vidal wrote, "Hatred of one parent or the other can make an Ivan the Terrible or a Hemingway. The protective love, however, of two devoted parents can absolutely destroy an artist. Early trauma and deprivation become the engines of some children's creativity. One researcher reviewed a list of eminent people and found that more than half had lost a parent before age 26. Triple the rate of the general population. A horrific upbringing can kill talent or bring it to life. It is a matter of having a match between how the parents act and what a particular child needs. Robert Sirota said, "It's very easy to destroy a talent. It's much less likely that nurture can create ability where none existed." Lang Lang, often billed as the world's most famous pianist, is the embodiment of brilliance honed in punishment. His father, Lang Guo Ren, wanted to be a musician but was assigned to a factory during the Cultural Revolution. When his 18-month-old son showed signs of being a prodigy, Lang Guo Ren's longing reared up. From the age of 3, Lang Lang woke up every morning at 5 to practice. "My passion was so huge that I wanted to eat the piano up," he said. His teacher was astonished by his memory. He could memorize 4 big pieces every week. My teacher was always telling her students to learn more, he said, but she was telling me to slow down. At 7, at China's first national children's competition in Taiyuan, he took an honorable mention for talent and rushed onto the stage shouting, "I don't want the prize for talent! I don't want it!" When another contestant ran over to comfort him, saying that he too had won an honorable mention, Lang Lang said, "You think you can compete with me? What the hell can you play?" Lang Lang's prize was a stuffed dog toy. He threw it in the mud and trampled it. But his father picked it up and kept it on the piano at home in Shenyang, so Lang Lang would never forget how much work he had to do. Lang Guoren had become a member of the special police, a prestigious job. He decided, however, that he had to take Lang Lang to Beijing to seek a place at the attached primary school of the Conservatory of Music, while Lang Lang's mother, Zhou Shulan, would stay behind to earn money to support her son and her husband. "I was 9, and it was really painful to leave home, and I realized that my father was quitting his job to be with me," Lang Lang said. "I felt such pressure." Lang Guoren taught Lang Lang his maxim, "Whatever other people have, I will definitely have. Whatever I have, nobody else will have." Lang Guoren described quitting his job as a kind of amputation. He rented the cheapest apartment they could find, without heat or running water, and told his son that the rent was much higher than it actually was. "That much money?" Lang Lang replied, shocked. "I had really better practice." He missed his mother terribly, and he often cried. Lang Guoren, who had always scorned domestic work, had to cook and clean. The teacher they had come to see in Beijing assessed Lang Lang harshly. "She said I played like a potato farmer," he recalled. "That I should taste Coca-Cola and play Mozart like that. My playing was flavorless water." She said, "You Northeasterners are big, coarse, and stupid." Eventually, she said, "Go home. Don't be a pianist." Then she fired me. Shortly thereafter, Lang Lang stayed after school to play piano for the celebration of the founding of the People's Republic of China, and he was 2 hours late coming home. When he walked in, Lang Guoren beat him with a shoe, then proffered a handful of pills and said, "You're a liar and you're lazy. You have no reason to live. You can't go back to Shenyang in shame. Dying is the only way out. Take these pills." When Lang Lang did not take the pills, Lang Guoren pushed the boy onto the apartment's balcony and told him to jump. Lang Guoren later explained his behavior with a Chinese proverb, "If you do not let go of your child, you cannot fight the wolves." In other words, coddling exposes everyone to disaster. But Lang Lang was furious and refused to touch the piano for months until his father swallowed his pride and begged him. Lang Guoren had also begged another teacher to work with his son and sat through the lesson so that he could reinforce the instruction at home. "He never smiled," Lang Lang said. "He was scaring me, sometimes beating me. We were like monks, the music monks." A family friend commented that Lang Guoren never showed affection or let his son know that he was pleased. It was only when his son was sound asleep that he would sit by him silently and gaze at him, fix his quilt, and touch his small feet, the friend wrote. When they went back to Shenyang for the summer, Lang Guoren treated the visit as a mere change of location for piano exercises. Zhou Shulan fought with him, demanding, "What does it matter to be a grand master? Or not a grand master? What the hell are you doing, acting as if you are preparing for war every day? How does this resemble a family?" Lang Lang would try to distract them from their arguments with his music. A friend said, every time they fought, his playing progressed. He worked so hard that he collapsed and had to go to the hospital for intravenous fluids every day. But his practice schedule never changed. My father is a real fascist, Lang Lang said. A prodigy can be very lonely, locked out of the world. He was finally accepted at the attached primary school, and then, at 11, he auditioned to represent China at the International Competition for Young Pianists in Germany. He was not selected. Lang Guoren told his wife that she had to raise enough money to enter Lang Lang privately, which was contrary to etiquette and potentially humiliating. Before the contest, Lang Guoren identified a blind pianist from Japan as Lang Lang's most serious opponent, and told Lang Lang to draw out his competitor about technique. Lang Lang then attempted to integrate the same approach into his own playing. When Lang Lang won, Lang Guoren sobbed for joy. When others told Lang Lang of his father's response, Lang Lang countered that his father was incapable of tears. In 1995, at 13, Lang Lang entered the second international Tchaikovsky competition for young musicians. His father would eavesdrop on the other contestants practicing, and urged Lang Lang to do the same if anyone was working on the same piece that he was. In Lang Guoren's view, if the pianist before you played with strength, you should play with delicacy. If he played softly, you should begin with strength. This tactic would make it easier for the judges to remember you, and would capture the attention of the audience. When someone later asked Lang Guoren how a 13-year-old could play something as heartbreaking as Chopin's second piano concerto for the finals, he said he told Lang Lang to think about his separation from his beloved mother and his beloved country. Lang Lang won. Within months, Lang Guoren withdrew his son from the Central Conservatory. He had arranged an audition with Gary Graftman at Curtis. Lang Lang recalled, "My dad said, the Chopin should be as light as the wind. The Beethoven should be heavy. When you use your explosive strength, be firm, generous, and natural, as if you were a mix of the English and Brazilian football teams." Lang Lang was accepted on the spot, and he and his father moved to the United States. During his first lesson at Curtis, Lang Lang said, "I'd like to win every competition that exists." Graftman said, "Why?" Lang Lang said, "To be famous." Graftman just laughed. But the other students told Lang Lang he should focus instead on being a superb musician. He didn't understand the difference. Though he has since learned tact, he has never entirely renounced this Olympic model. Graftman said to me, "With most students, you want to get them excited about the emotional content of the music. With Lang Lang, it was just the opposite. I had to calm him down enough so he could learn." At 17, Lang Lang acquired a manager, who got him his first big break at the Ravinia Festival outside Chicago. The critics were enraptured, and for the next 2 years, Lang Lang sold out every concert, made numerous recordings, graced the covers of glossy magazines. "The higher the expectations, the better I play," he told me. "Carnegie Hall makes me play best of all." Every tremendous prodigy story, like every political career, contains a backlash sequence that shocks the protagonist. The listening world has to go through its own rejecting adolescence between its childish rhapsody and its adult respect. Schadenfreude often makes the backlash mean. Lang Lang is socially porous, with a sensitivity to pleasing his specific audience that often seems reminiscent more of Beyoncé than of Svatoslav Richter. Though these qualities are not incompatible with profundity, his playing to the gallery offends some sophisticates. The extent of Lang Lang's self-branding is indicated by his having trademarked his name. He performs as Lang Lang TM. He has signed endorsement deals with Audi, Montblanc, Sony, Adidas, Rolex, and Steinway. John von Rhein of the Chicago Tribune, who had helped launch Lang Lang's career, said a few years later, "The music became an accessory to the soloist's acrobatic performance. All he needed was a white sequin suit and a candelabra, and Ravinia could have sold him as the new Liberace." Anthony Tomasini of the New York Times wrote that Lang Lang's solo debut at Carnegie Hall in 2003 was incoherent, self-indulgent, and slam-bang crass. The narrative tension between composers' masterworks and Lang Lang's reading of them is exaggerated by his having grown up in a non-Western culture. Western classical music in China is usually like Chinese food in the West. "Familiar, but not quite the real thing," Lang Lang said. He can do an impeccable rendition of a Mendelssohn concerto and follow it up with a self-indulgent Mozart sonata played with inflated dynamics and distended tempo. But then he'll play elegantly again, and critics will have to acknowledge his mastery. 5 years after condemning him so sharply, Tomasini wrote that Lang Lang played with utter command and disarming joy. "When I see Lang Lang in concert, I am always struck by how much fun he appears to be having. I'm not just giving as a performer," he said to me. "I'm also taking. My father is an introvert, my mother is an extrovert, and I am both. My father's discipline and my mother's happiness." I first sat down with Lang Lang in 2005, in Chicago, when he was 23. I had gone that afternoon to a particularly lovely performance in which he played the Chopin Piano Sonata No. 3 in B minor. Following the performance, a line of some 400 people waited patiently to get his autograph on their CDs, and Lang Lang never flagged. Afterward, Lang Lang invited me to talk in his room. When we arrived, Lang Guoren was watching television. He shook my hand, we exchanged pleasantries, and then, with his characteristic mix of brusqueness and intimacy, he took off his clothes and lay down for a nap. In my experience, everyone likes Lang Lang, and no one likes Lang Guoren. But Lang Lang is not as warm as he seems, and his father is not as harsh as he seems. They are collaborators in a single phenomenon. "When I turned 20 and became a huge success, I started to love my father," Lang Lang told me. "He listens very well, and he helps me do the laundry, pack. I'm a spoiled kid. After a big recital, nobody else is going to do a little massage at 2 o'clock in the morning while talking about the performance." I once told Lang Lang that by American standards, his father's methods would count as child abuse, and that their present conviviality was startling to me. "If my father had pressured me like this, and I had not done well, it would have been child abuse, and I would be traumatized, maybe destroyed," Lang Lang responded. "He could have been less extreme, and we probably would have made it to the same place. You don't have to sacrifice everything to be a musician. But we had the same goal. So since all the pressure helped me become a world-famous star musician, which I love being, I would say that, for me, it was in the end a wonderful way to grow up." Several recent books hark back to the adage that practice makes perfect, setting the workload for mastery at 10,000 hours. The number is extrapolated from the observation by the Swedish psychologist K. Anders Ericsson that by 20, the top violinists at Berlin's Academy of Music had practiced an average of 10,000 hours over a decade, approximately 2,500 hours more than the next most accomplished group. Skills and perhaps neurosystems develop through drilling. Recent surveys in which people were ranked for talent and then followed for practice time showed that practice time mattered more than talent. David Brooks wrote in the New York Times, "The primary trait is not some mysterious genius. It's the ability to develop a deliberate, strenuous, and boring practice routine. We construct ourselves through behavior." There is, without question, considerable truth in this idea. If this were not the case, education would be futile, and experience would be a waste of time. I'd much rather go up in a plane with a pilot who's been flying for a decade than with one who's on his maiden flight. And no one chooses to eat anyone's first souffle. But the sanctification of 10,000 hours as the basis for achievement has a Horatio Alger-like sentimentality to it. Leopold Auer, the last century's great violin pedagogue, used to tell pupils, "Practice 3 hours a day if you are any good, 4 if you are a little stupid. If you need more than that, stop. You should try another profession." The inclination to practice assiduously may itself be inborn, and nourishing it may be at least as important as nourishing basic talent. The Stanford psychologist Walter Mischel developed the so-called marshmallow test in the 1960s. A child between 4 and 6 years old was sequestered with a marshmallow and told that he could eat it right away, or he could wait 15 minutes and get an extra marshmallow. The children who could wait went on to have SAT scores on average 210 points higher than those of the children who could not. More recently, Angela Lee Duckworth, a psychologist at the University of Pennsylvania, gave high schoolers the choice between $1 right away and $2 in a week. And once more, those who could delay gratification had much higher levels of academic achievement, regardless of IQ. "Intelligence is really important," she said, "but it's still not as important as self-control." Ellen Winner, who studies genius, has delineated a struggle between the common-sense myth that giftedness is innate and the psychologist's myth that giftedness is accrued through labor and study. The critic Edward Rothstein wrote, "The contemporary attack on genius is itself a mythology, an attempt to grasp the ungraspable by diminishing it, reducing it." Rothstein suggests that those who emphasize the role of sheer labor listen to Bach and Beethoven and try on the idea that they could have composed such music with sufficient effort. Veda Kaplinsky jokingly compared the question to what she'd once heard a psychiatrist say about sex in a marriage. "If the sex is good, it's 10%. If it's bad, it's 90%. She explained, "If the talent is there, it's 10% of the package. If the talent is not there, it becomes 90% because they can't overcome the lack of it. But just having talent is really a very minor part of what is necessary in order to make it in music." Musicians often talk to me about whether you achieve brilliance on the violin by practicing for hours every day, or by reading Shakespeare, learning physics, and falling in love. The violinist Yehudi Menuhin said, "Maturity, in music and in life, has to be earned by living." The composer and performer Gabriel Kahane said, "There is always a Korean girl who has been locked in the basement practicing for longer than you have. You can't win that game." But more profoundly, normal life in these contexts is a euphemism for a richer life. Single-minded devotion to an instrument builds proficiency, but music embraces experience. When I said that I was writing about prodigies, people kept mentioning a 7-year-old pianist named Mark Yu, who had appeared on Jay Leno, Ellen DeGeneres, and Oprah. I was invited to his New York debut, a recital in the Park Avenue apartment of a Shanghai socialite. Mark had just turned 8, but his small stature made him look about 6. He would solemnly lisp the name of his next selection, play it with incongruous power and musicality, then spin around to look at his dazzling mother, Chloe, to see how he'd done. Because Mark's legs were short, a little platform had been set up with extenders that allowed him to control the pedals. As he was playing a Chopin nocturne, the contraption shifted, and the pedals ceased to respond. Chloe crawled into the tight space below her son's pumping legs and began trying to realign the device. Mark didn't miss a note. Chloe couldn't make the thing work, so she kept lifting it and slamming it back down. It was so incongruous, the little boy intent on his fingering, and the stunning woman in her gown crouched noisily at his feet, the melodies pouring forth. It was as though Mark and Chloe were in a dialogue that the rest of us had stumbled on, a private interaction that could, ironically, take place only with an audience. Well after the recital had ended, and long past the bedtime of most 8-year-olds, Mark announced that he had learned the Emperor Concerto, and he played it for a few of us, counting out long silences for the orchestral passages so he could come in exactly on cue. He brimmed with impatient, eager bravado, much as my 8-year-old niece does when she wants me to admire her swimming. As Mark made conversation with adults who were fascinated by him, but not much interested in what he had to say, I guessed that his relationship with his mother might be the only one in which he is not anomalous. Chloe Yu was born in Macau and came to the United States to study when she was 17. She married at 25, and Mark was born a year later in Pasadena. From that day, Chloe played the piano to him. He didn't start to speak until after he turned 2, Chloe recalled. I was worried. Then he started speaking English, Cantonese, Mandarin, and a little bit of Shanghainese as well. I was so relieved. When Mark was almost 3, he picked out a few tunes on the piano with 2 fingers. In a year, he had surpassed Chloe's ability to teach him. At 5, he added the cello to his regimen. Soon he asked for more instruments, Chloe recalled. I said, "That's it, Mark. Be realistic. 2 is enough." Chloe gave up the master's degree she'd been working on. She had divorced Mark's father, but because she had no money, she and Mark ended up living with her ex-in-laws, who gave them a room over the garage. Mark's grandparents did not approve of his excessive devotion to the piano. His grandmother loves him a lot, Chloe said, but she just wanted him to be a normal 5-year-old. When Mark was in preschool, Chloe felt he was ready to perform and contacted local retirement facilities and hospitals and offered free recitals so Mark could do so without pressure. Soon the papers were writing about this young genius. When I began to understand how talented he is, I was so excited, Chloe said, and also so afraid. At 6, Mark won a fellowship for gifted youth that covered the down payment on a Steinway. By the time Mark was 8, he and Chloe were flying to China bimonthly so that Mark could study with Dr. Minduo Li. Chloe explained that whereas her son's American teachers gave him broad interpretive ideas to explore freely, Dr. Li taught Mark measure by measure. In the future, Mark will be telling people, "I'm American-born but trained in China." China will love him for that. I asked Mark whether he found it difficult traveling so far for his lessons. "Well, fortunately, I don't have vestigial somnolence," he said. I raised my eyebrow. "You know, jet lag," he apologized. Mark was being homeschooled to accommodate his performance and practice schedule. "After a huge breakfast, he's sleepy," Chloe said. "So we schedule something less intense, work on technique, maybe do homework. In the late morning, he has a nap, and then he'll do something that will use his brain, learn new material. It's all about time management. He should be just in third grade, but he's ahead in all subjects." Mark was doing college prep work and taking an SAT class. Chloe serves as his manager and reviews concert invitations with him. "I consult my boss first," Chloe said. Mark looked at her with an expression of frank incredulity. "I'm your boss?" he asked. Later, Chloe said, "If he changes his mind and wants to become a mathematician, I'd accept it. Maybe initially I would be upset because we have spent so much time on this. It would be just like breaking up with your boyfriend. It's not easy, right?" Mark said reassuringly, "I like piano. It's what I'm going to do." Chloe smiled. "Right now, yes. But you can never tell. You're only 8. To play as Mark does requires an extraordinary level of concentration. Mark said, "How much I practice depends on my mood. Like if I really want to accomplish something or it's before a concert, I would say 6 to 8 hours per day. But if I'm not really in the mood to practice, maybe 4 to 5 hours. I was interested in composing, but I've decided I need to focus." His playing has required equal discipline from Chloe. I asked her whether she thought about her old ambitions. She smiled and held out her arms to Mark. "This is my work," she said. When I visited them in L.A., Chloe had just remarried, and Mark had played at the wedding banquet. Chloe refused to move into a house with her new husband, however, because she thought it would interfere with practicing with Mark. Instead, they live a few streets apart. I was reminded of couples with disabled children who are split by the unusual needs of their sons and daughters. Children like to have heroes, and Mark's is Lang Lang. After reading a story in the Los Angeles Times magazine in which Mark declared his admiration, Lang Lang got in touch. "I admire Lang Guoren a lot," Chloe said. "I don't want to hear the word pushy used about me, but I want to be strong for Mark the way he was strong for Lang Lang." A few years later, Lang Lang arranged for Mark to perform with him at the Royal Albert Hall. "I attended the concert, and when we all met afterward, I was struck by Lang Lang's avuncular gentleness with his protege. I had never seen him so vulnerable." I asked Chloe what she thought about the 10,000 hours. "It's more about nurture, I believe, than nature," Chloe said. "Mark's father had no interest in music, so the nature came from my side. The nurture came from me, too." She has strong views on American parenting. "In America, every kid has to be well-rounded. They have 10 different activities, and they never excel at any of them. Americans want everyone to have the same life. It's a cult of the average. This is wonderful for disabled children who get things they would never have otherwise, but it's a disaster for gifted children. Why should Mark spend his life learning sports he's not interested in when he has this superb gift that gives him so much joy?" Back in California, I asked Mark what he thought of a normal childhood. "I already have a normal childhood," he said. "Do Do you want to see my room? It's messy, but you can come anyway. So I went upstairs with him. He showed me a yellow remote-controlled helicopter that his father had sent from China. The bookshelves were crammed with Dr. Seuss, Jumanji,